Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hi there, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the darkened corridors of power, and we shine a light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. Purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right front and center to face the music and dance together. In other words, to address problems instead of defending positions. You know, after the bank bailout in 2009, Swami would get a lot of laughs with his line, "I am nostalgic about the good old days. Remember when people robbed banks?" Well, maybe it's not that funny. When I traveled to Washington, D.C. about a week or two after the 2008 election, the sense was it was like dancing in the streets. The mood felt like the liberation of Paris or the fall of the Berlin Wall. But a lad and a lack. For many complex reasons, Obama bailed out Wall Street, but not Main Street. And in the past 10 years, we've come to recognize that those financial institutions that were too big to fail were not too big to fail the American people. So as a result, the American middle class seems to have gone the way of the typewriter and the slide rule, as the gap between rich and poor actually grew during the Obama administration. Bank loans for new businesses have been replaced with credit card debt that's further impoverished local enterprise, while the mega banks continue to make mega profits. Our guest this week, Ellen Brown, is here to clear the air about our financial system and spray that mysterious black box called the banking system with demystifier. Ellen is the founder of the Public Banking Institute and the author of a dozen books and hundreds of articles. She developed her research skills as an attorney practicing civil litigation in L.A. And in the best-selling book, Web of Debt, she turned those skills to an analysis of the Federal Reserve and the Money Trust, showing how this private cartel has usurped the power to create money from the people themselves and how we the people can get it back. That led to her second book, The Public Banking Solution, her latest book, which we'll be discussing today, Banking on the People, Democratizing Money in the Digital Age, takes the reader step by step through what she calls the sausage factory of modern money creation, and she explores improvements made possible by advances in digital technology and proposes breakthrough upgrades that could transform our outmoded 19th century system into one that is democratic, sustainable, and serves the needs of the 21st century. Welcome, Ellen.
Oh, thanks, Steve. Great to be talking to you.
Great. Now, you've written three books about money and the banking system. What was it that first got you, that shifted your attention to the banking system and money?
Well, my first 10 books were actually on alternative healthcare and the pharmaceutical industry. And at some point, I realized that if you wanted to crack that nut, you really had to look at the banking system because that's where they got their power. They were the pharmaceutical, it was like the medical, pharmaceutical, banking, oil, corporate cartel. So I had actually researched the Federal Reserve in my younger days when I different things I wanted to write about. But at that time, it was before the internet, and you couldn't really get to the end of your quest. You know, you go to the library and the books wouldn't be there or whatever. So I just refocused my attention on that issue. And when I learned that the Wizard of Oz was written as a monetary allegory in the late 19th century, that gave me a hook. So that got me started. So I spent 6 years writing Web of Debt. At that time, I wasn't, you know, head of a banking or public banking institute. And so I had a lot more time to lavish over images and, you know, make it creative and story-like and all that. So I really enjoyed writing that book. And then the other two have developed from that and from the Public Banking Institute and from our efforts to set up public banks and different barriers we've met. And, you know, we really do need to rethink our system. Under the current system, we're kind of locked in. We need to change some laws, it seems to me.
So your first work really had a lot to do with alternative health. I understand that you were as an attorney, you were working with a clinic. Was it in Mexico? Just say a little bit more about that, because I think that, as you said, all of these situations are intertwined and intertangled, and some of the leverage that's been used on us related to health is related to who benefits financially. Tell us a little bit about that. How's that project came about?
Okay, well, I worked for 10 years as a lawyer in Los Angeles, but we just did basic business and corporate law. But some of our clients were banks, and so I got familiar with that industry. And then my ex-husband burned out on Beverly Hills law and wanted to go in the Foreign Service, so he joined USAID, and we traveled. So we went to Kenya. We lived in, for 11 years, we lived in Kenya, Honduras, Nicaragua, and Guatemala. And I would come home for the summers, and my co-author on four of those health books wanted to go to Tijuana and check out the cancer clinics because she had heard some good things about them. And so we went on a tour, and the most impressive one was the last one, Jimmy Keller's clinic. In fact, it was like a revival. I mean, you had these patients that got up and cried and said how wonderful it was and how they'd been saved from these horrible conditions. And, you know, I was a little skeptical at the time, but later someone from a patient called me and said that Jimmy was in jail and that he actually had attorneys, but they were constitutional law attorneys, and he didn't actually trust them. So he wanted me to work on his case because I had written an article on it and he had read the article. And so there was no way I could do it when I was in the Foreign Service, but alone. But I met another attorney who was working in that field who actually represented alternative healthcare practitioners, and he wanted to do it. So we did it together. And over the course of 7 years, I spent a lot of time interviewing witnesses, and Jimmy wound up in jail for 4 years. And so I spent a lot of time in jail with him, interviewing him. And I just learned a whole lot about the whole cancer industry and the drug industry, surgery, how that all evolved. And I wrote it up as a book. And it was actually Jimmy Keller that got me into being sort of seeing the dark side of things or the underside of things. And he was highly suspicious of the Federal Reserve and pointed me to different things. He's now passed away, but he's a Southern Republican, you know, totally coming from a different place than I was coming from. So it was all an eye opener to me. So that's what got me started. But I wouldn't have had anything to write about if I hadn't discovered that The Wizard of Oz was written as a monetary allegory. Because I read all these books and I understood what was going on, but I didn't really know what I could contribute. What could I say that was different, or how would I make my book interesting and distinguish it from the other books? And so that gave me a hook, and I took off running and really, you know, quite got into it as a sort of work of art.
You know, it really, I loved The Web of Dead. It was a life-changing book for me. And I first discovered it at a progressive conference, Georgia Kelly Praxis Peace Institute 2009 conference on economics and peace. And what I found about The Web of Dead is that it made a bridge between things that were, as you suggested, understood by the conservative side, you know, the creature from Jekyll Island, you know, that talked about how the Federal Reserve and the tax, the income tax were created. And then all of a sudden, this book, these ideas are being introduced to progressives, I think, for the first time. That's what I found so hugely valuable about it. Did you find that that was that book made a bridge in your experience?
Yes. People wrote, somebody wrote to me once and said, I can tell from your book that you're a Republican. So he was going to put me in touch with one of the Republican candidates because it really was a Republican issue or a conservative issue. Strangely, Democrats, who you would think would be more inclined towards socialism and government-owned banks, were not really interested. It seemed like, I mean, even now, it seems like it's the right that maybe it's the right that has a sort of more conspiratorial view of things in general. I'm not sure why that is, but it was an issue on the right. But of course, The Creature from Jekyll Island, I love that book all the way up till the end. And his solution was that we should go back to gold. And I was kind of shocked. I thought, you're kidding, because it's just not going to, in my opinion, it won't work to go back to gold. I mean, that was the source of the problem. It was too limited. We don't have the gold. It's because of the gold we wound up with a fractional reserve system, et cetera. So anyway, I thought it needed another solution. And when I wrote Web of Debt, my solution was that the government should issue the money. But it's very difficult to persuade Congress that they should be issuing the money. Somehow they prefer to borrow than to issue money directly. And the more I thought about it, I thought, that the whole banking system and the whole fractional reserve system was not bad. What was bad was the fact that it was privately owned. If it were a public utility, the fact that the government can create money, or the bank can create money in the form of debt, is a good thing. Really what they're doing is turning your own credit into something you can spend in the marketplace. Like if you tried to write out your own IOU to your grocer, at least my grocer, my big, big corporate grocer wouldn't take it because they don't know me and they don't know what would be backing this paper. But if you go to the bank, they will turn your IOU into something you can spend in the marketplace. And that's basically where 95% of our money comes from now, according to, the Federal Reserve said it long ago in a sort of obscure several obscure publications. But recently, the Bank of England confirmed that banks don't really lend their depositors money. They don't, contrary to popular belief, they don't just take in deposits and lend them out again. They actually create deposits when they make loans. And in fact, said the Bank of England, that's the source of 97% of the UK money supply, and in the US it's a little less, but roughly 95%. So if banks create money, it seemed to me that, and if we want to work with the system we have, I mean, it's just very hard to do very radical change at a federal level, then it seemed to me that the solution for now would be to make the banks into public institutions. And we have one stellar model, which is the Bank of North Dakota, which has celebrated its 100th year anniversary this year. And there was an article in 2014 in the Wall Street Journal that said the Bank of North Dakota was actually more profitable than Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan Chase. And they're not even trying to be profitable. Their mandate is to serve the local community. But in the course of that, just because of this whole cooperative public model, they do manage to be very, very profitable, leveraging the funds of the state for the benefit of the local community. So that was that. But then this, my latest book, Banking on the People, we've been trying to set up public banks now for a decade, and there are a lot of rules that just don't really apply to a public bank that we have to try to overcome. I mean, we've been kind of hamstrung. We still have hope. We have bills. We have over 25 active bills right now in different cities and states across the country. And the one that's really moving at the moment is in California to change the California banking laws to allow a special charter for a public bank. So it wouldn't have quite so many rules as a private bank. And it would allow us to set up banks a little better. But anyway, in the public bank solution, I was looking ahead at what the possibilities are and how we could actually change the whole system. After 2008, we saw that the Federal Reserve can do amazing things. We saw that it could create $3.7 trillion worth of, that's what they created in excess reserves and bought up toxic mortgage-backed securities off the books of the banks, and then they bought up $2.7 trillion of that is federal debt, federal bonds. And it didn't create runaway inflation like everybody thought, and now we've seen the Bank of Japan now owns 50% of their federal debt. The central bank owns 50% of the government's debt. If we did that, that would be $11 trillion that the Federal Reserve would hold, and still, Japan's inflation rate is under 2%. They're trying to get it up to 2%, and they can't seem to do it. And in China, they have increased the money supply by 18 times in the last 20 years, and they, too, do not have runaway inflation. They, right up till last December, they, too, hadn't even gotten up to 2% inflation. It's gone up a bit now because apparently there was a swine flu epidemic, and pork is a big element of their economy, so it's up a bit, but it's still very low. It's not the hyperinflation that everybody predicts.
Good. Well, we'll be back with Ellen Brown shortly after this break, and we'll talk more about her new book and what happened with the bailout and what we can do now. Steve Behrman, this is Wiki Politiki.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
911, what is your emergency?
Where's the wounds?
911, what's your emergency?
Please help. My son shot his brother.
911, what is your emergency? 911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Hi, Hi, this is Steve Behrman. We're back on segment two with our guest, Ellen Brown, talking about her most recent book, Banking on the People. Now, a question that I had, again, when I read Web of Debt, when I saw the original Creature from Jekyll Island that talked about Federal Reserve, one of the things that really struck me is that when money is issued as debt, it just simply metastasizes and cannot be paid unless some way is, as you had suggested, where the government, who are the ones who are supposed to issue money, buy up this debt. Say a little more about how the bailout, how and why the bailout happened the way it did. How come? Why was money not put in from the bottom up to bubble up? Why didn't they send everybody a check for $10,000 so that money could be spent up the system rather than down? And what happened with the bailout?
Well, in the bailout, the banks, the big banks, of course, were bailed out. First, it was $700 billion that came out of taxpayer money that, came from Congress. And after that, the Federal Reserve, in a rather stealth manner that we didn't know about until Bernie Sanders made them reveal their books, came up with between $14 trillion and $29 trillion, depending on who you read, of credit, essentially, that they extended to the banks, virtually interest-free. It was like 0.25%, but when you take in consider inflation, it was like 0%. So these were interest-free loans made to the banks. And the way the system is set up, the Federal Reserve can only deal with the bank's reserve accounts. So what they did was they swapped reserves or they made loans by putting the money into the reserve accounts. And when they did the quantitative easing, they swapped these reserves for at first mortgage-backed securities and then for U.S. government bonds. So anyway, it all happens in the reserve accounts of the banks. In fact, there are two banking systems, and we don't get to play in the reserve in the bank's banking system. All we have are bank IOUs. So all we have are sort of reflections of that Federal Reserve system. So that's one thing I was proposing. No, I didn't make this up. I based it on several sets of economists who have proposed that we could open up the Federal Reserve's deposit window to everyone. So right now the banks are getting 2.35% on their reserves, which they it's absolutely risk-free because the Federal Reserve can't go bankrupt. They create the money. And they're just getting free money, and we, the people, are getting virtually nothing on our deposits. So, among other things, opening up the Fed's deposit window would give us some interest. It would prevent bank runs because the Federal Reserve can't go bankrupt. And there would be no need for deposit insurance because, again, the Federal Reserve can't go bankrupt. So you don't have to have that $250,000 ceiling, which means that the big institutional players like the pension funds and hedge funds, et cetera, could also bank at the Federal Reserve. And this would eliminate the need for or a large part of the reason for the existence of the repo market and the shadow banking system, which is quite risky and is really what went down in 2008. But I think I'm getting off the topic. So
Well, here? I think this is all really very interesting because, a lot of these terms like the repo market, et cetera, it's part of that black, mysterious black box that people don't understand. Say a little bit about what this repo market is. How did we shift from the old bank from It's a Wonderful Life where people – took their savings and put it in the savings and loan of the, let's say, 1940s to what we have right now, where if people want to finance their business, they run it up on credit card debt. How did we get to that particular state of affairs where, Main Street is really not being served by the banking system?
Right. And I'll just go back to one point what you asked earlier about why didn't they put the money into the regular economy? I think Obama actually asked, asked the head of the Fed, skip my mind.
Whoever he was at that time, yeah.
Yeah. Damn, he's got the little beard. He's bald. Ask him why couldn't the Federal Reserve make interest-free loans to state and local governments, just as they had done to the for the banks? And he said that they weren't allowed to in the Federal Reserve Act. They could only make loans to banks. So that's one thing that I think absolutely needs to get changed. Is we need to modify the Federal Reserve Act. And right now there's a big push for modern monetary theory, or the Green New Deal people are pushing modern monetary theory, which says that we can spend a lot more than we are spending and it won't create hyperinflation like everybody thinks, or, you know, it won't be a disaster. But we really can't at the moment. The government is not allowed to issue debt and sell it directly to the Federal Reserve, and they can't make the Federal Reserve buy it. I mean, if the Fed wants to buy it, great. If the Fed decides they want to do quantitative easing, great. But they're not working together. And in Japan, for example, the law is different, and the law actually says that the central bank and the central government are supposed to work together in developing monetary and fiscal policy. So the result of that is Abenomics, where the government is spending a lot to stimulate the economy, but the deal is they already have a deal with the Bank of Japan that the Bank of Japan will buy up the debt. Ben Bernanke. I don't know why that's
the man, Ben Bernanke. Yes, we remember that.
Yeah, okay. So anyway, that's what Bernanke said. So we have to change the law, and it seems to me we could change the law to say, at one time, the Federal Reserve Act said that loans could be made in exigent circumstances to corporations and to, you know, non-banks. And they did that. They did that in the 30s for like 20 years or so. And then they changed that rule. But they for that 20-year period, it didn't require exigent circumstances. Then they changed it to require just in emergencies. But they used it to bail out General Motors and, you know, other specific corporations. And so in 2010, when they did the Dodd-Frank Act, they changed the rule again, and because it was considered unfair that they would target specific corporations and save them and not other ones. So they changed the rule to say that they could do it only to broad categories. So you could say, for example, I guess this is what it, or this is what one professor, economics professor, interprets it to mean, that you could say make loans to all the auto companies, not specifically General Motors, or to all the states, let's say, all the state and local governments, and not just maybe California or some specific state. So they're allowed to do that now under the Dodd-Frank Act. But what they need to do, it seems to me, is open it up to say that the central bank and Congress should work together to work out what they're going to spend, and the fact that the Federal Reserve is going to finance that by buying the bonds. If the Fed buys the bonds, then they are effectively interest-free, because the Fed returns its interest to, or its profits to, the government after deducting its costs. But now one of its costs is that they're paying on half trillion excess reserves that are now sitting in the Fed Reserve account. So that's a big chunk of money that's going to the banks. Anyway, so back. Sorry, no, I've forgotten your question.
And how is it that say more about the repo? I think people need to know a little bit more about that.
Yeah. Okay, so that was actually what collapsed in 2008. There was a run on the repo market. So all the big investors over $250,000 don't want to put their money in banks because they're not protected in the event of a bank going bankrupt. And so, but they wanted a similar protection. They wanted something that was equally liquid where they could put their money in, they could withdraw their money on a day's notice. So the repo market was developed sort of like a pawn shop, where the big institutional investor, or whoever the investor is, would lend money. But it was actually a purchase and sale. So you would sell, instead of calling it a loan, which would go through, well, this gets very complicated. But anyway, it was considered a purchase and sale where the lender would actually sell this repo to the borrower. But the deal was that they could buy it back on a day's notice. And so it wasn't really a sale because it had that provision in there that they could buy it back. And so that's what happened when people were worried about, or the big investors were worried about Lehman Brothers and the Fannie and Freddie and different crises that were happening in the banking system. They panicked and pulled their money out of the repo market very quickly. So that market was used by that market was used by Lehman Brothers. I think that happened before Lehman Brothers collapsed. And so these big investment banks particularly had borrowed heavily in the repo market, but ordinary banks borrow in the repo market too. They need to get, even though they create the money they lend on their books, they need to come up with liquidity if the depositors want their money and they don't have sufficient funds. I mean, it's a wonderful life scenario. If that happens and all the depositors come and want their money, then the bank has to come up with the money somewhere. So ideally what they do, of course, first they borrow from their depositors. If they don't have the deposits, then they borrow from other banks. So they do that in the Fed funds market. But the other alternative is to go to the repo market, which quite often is cheaper even than the Fed funds market. So everybody, or all these big financial institutions, were wrapped up in the repo market. So when it went down, it caused these riskier investment banks to go down. And then everybody was afraid to lend. I mean, all the big financial institutions were afraid to lend to others because nobody knew where the risk was buried. And so the whole market froze. And that's what went down. But we actually need the repo market the way our system is set up now. We need the shadow banking system. We need some source of liquidity because our whole system is based on this inherent fraud that the banks have the money that they create on their books, but they really don't have it. So they have to scramble around and get it. They borrow it overnight. If they were using the repo market, they would borrow it overnight, which is when anybody looks at the books to see if their books balance, and then they give it back the next day, and then at the end of the day they borrow it again. So it's clearly fraudulent. But they go through that whole thing to make it look like their books balance. But it seems to me we could eliminate that step. Let's acknowledge that all money is simply credit, that all it is a monetization of your own credit or of the borrower's own credit. That's where most of our money comes from. A little bit comes from cash created by the Fed, but most of it is just bank loans. And the presumption is that the lender has to get that money from somewhere, but they don't. If the lender were a public institution, if it were a public utility, if you were just going to, you could call it the central bank, but I prefer to think of it as a banking network where you're actually going to your local public bank, which would be making the lending decisions, not the central bank, which everybody distrusts. You'd be going to your local bank, which would decide whether you're creditworthy, and they would extend the money. That's what China does pretty much. If if their loans go bad, they call them non-performing loans, but they don't put the bank into bankruptcy. They just carry the non-performing loans. So they issue the money. They hope it gets paid back. If it doesn't, they just carry it on the books. And everybody, the foreigners, you know, object that they have all these high non-performing loans and the system's going to collapse. But it won't collapse as long as the government decides not to collapse it. If they want to keep these banks alive, they'll stay alive. So if that was a public system, we could keep the whole thing propped up in the same way. It, just acknowledging that you don't need to get the money from somewhere. It's just credit, and you're just monetizing or turning into money the future ability to repay of the borrower.
You know, this is very reminiscent of what was happening in the colonies at the time of the American Revolution. Excuse me. And there was a colonial script, and it was really based on it was a true fiat currency that was simply based on trust, and some of them worked better than others. But when it did work, it was basically people holding these IOUs, essentially, and recognizing that they had value because everybody agreed that they had value, and that allowed commerce, it allowed this money, this magical thing, to circulate and continue circulating through all of these systems. And now that we have the power of and potential of digital currency, there's a whole lot more that we can do. So in the final segment, I'd like to talk more about what are some of the solutions that can be put into practice and how people can find out more about these things. I was fascinated with the idea of quote-unquote public utilities. I remember I heard you once talking about maybe we should make Amazon a public utility, and I kind of like that idea, because if it's a necessity that everybody has to use, then it's a natural monopoly that is – there can be a lot of mischief that can take place around these natural monopolies, where there's income centers that are privatized that only a few people can have access to rather than whole groups. So we're going to take a break and come back with Ellen Brown and talking about banking on the people. Steve Behrman and Wiki Politiki.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network, presenting transformative programs and events to help you awaken to your full potential, so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Thank you. We're back on WikiPolitiki with our guest, Alan Brown, and we're talking about the banking system. I'm totally fascinated with this idea of public utilities. The two things I want to talk about in this final segment. Number one, how does the digital revolution impact the potential for our banking system, not just in terms of alternative currencies, but also in terms of efficiency in the system as it is? And then tell us more about the idea of public utilities and some of the solutions that you offer that could, you know, restore Main Street as opposed to Wall Street.
Okay. Well, it's because of the development of digital currencies that this idea has been broached of opening up the Fed's discount window, or sorry, the Fed's deposit window. The reason, what you could do, let's say a network of public banks and people's accounts are held at these banks, you can, everything goes digital. I mean, we already have a digital currency. Most of our currency is digital. The only alternative is cash, of which only a few percentage points of the money supply consists. So all the rest is digital, and it's held at our banks. So that's why the central bank could, for example, do a universal basic income very simply, just by it would just be a few clicks of the keyboard, and you could send everybody $1,000 a month into their digital accounts. And if you wanted to make it so that this would pay off their debts automatically, or that it would go first to pay off debt, which I think would be a good idea, because that when you pay off debt, you actually extinguish money. Money is created as a loan, and it's extinguished when the debt is paid off. So if that universal basic income went automatically to pay off the debts that would be held in the same bank, I mean, the bank would know what your debts were, then this could all be done very simply, very automatically. It's not a matter of – it's not like the old days where you'd have to be toting cash around. Right now we have Libra, which is a serious threat to our banking system, because Libra is the Facebook digital currency. That Bitcoin was the first, of course, to sort of challenge the system, but Bitcoin is too slow, too expensive, too energy intensive to actually use as a national currency. But Facebook has already a huge market. The majority of the Facebook market is not Americans. And this new digital currency that they have established, or have done a white paper on, it's not established yet, will be based in Switzerland. So our government doesn't even have any leverage over it. I mean, we can ask that it be investigated, but they can really do what they want. And it's founded by the founding members are Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, Uber. I mean, you have to wonder if it's supposedly competing with Visa and MasterCard, why are they the founding members? And they all put up $10 million in order to get this membership, and they will get a percentage of the proceeds. So all this money that you will give to Libra in exchange for their Libra currency, the founders, the owners, will be able to invest, and they will be getting the profits. So you won't get any interest. It's the investors that will get it. And you really have no protection. I mean, you don't have a central bank backing it. If for some reason one of these exchanges that you're using, or it's probably going to be the Calibra exchange, which is the Libra exchange, they're counting on, they're going to have the central bank, basically, which will be Calibra. So if the exchange if there's a run on the exchange, then there's no way you can get your money back. There's nobody to get it back from. If you buy a product that is not, you don't get what you were asking for, there's no Visa to go and, or sorry, no bank to go and challenge your Visa charge or whatever. So you're just stuck with it. So it's a very frightening development. It seems for that reason alone, it seems to me we need to establish a national digital currency that is a public utility owned by the people, not owned by the banks, and make the central bank be a public utility, rewrite the law, so rewrite the Federal Reserve Act so that the central bank is there to serve the public and not just there to serve the banks. With Amazon, as you point out, it is a monopoly, so it seems like there would be grounds to challenge it under antitrust laws, and that would actually work really well to have a national Amazon sort of supermarket. It would be basically a national community currency where you could sell your wares on this big exchange, and you would get the national currency for it, the digital currency, and then you could spend that digital currency on all the other wares. The reason community currency, one reason community currencies don't get very far is they're just too limited. They're based on trust. You have to trust the other members because you don't have a government backing it. And I saw some study somewhere that said you really can't trust more than 1,500 people. And that's as big of a community as you can really work a community currency in. But if you had a national currency backed by the government and you had all these immense products, you know, all the products that you wanted would be there, I think you would have a community currency that could be essentially free. You could be doing exchanges for free.
You know, that's why, you know, Libra is quite dangerous because there is no recourse. Talk about privatization. That's like the ultimate in privatization. In terms of creating the public utility, you had mentioned the guaranteed national income. I noticed that in your book, you also you cite Scott Smith's proposal for essentially doing away with the income tax and creating instead a transactions tax, and he's shown that how possible that is. What seems to be the issue is, how do we create something that I think the public, were they educated about it, would say, yes, we want this. How do we get to that state where we can actually have legislation to make the banking industry a public utility? Are there legislators on the left and on the right who are aware of this and it's on their radar and they're interested in, you know, bringing this to reality?
Well, the millennials are very inspiring to me. It's the millennials who have taken up the cause of public banking in California. They got the bill, or they pretty much got the bill introduced for, or the measure introduced in Los Angeles for a to set up a Los Angeles publicly owned bank. It didn't pass, but it did get 42% of the vote, and they're just waiting on this new bill that would change the charter provisions to bring that bill again. And it's the millennials that are pushing the bill to change the charter provisions. And then on the federal level, we have Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the Green New Deal group, which is largely millennials. And they incorporated into their proposal that it would be funded by, the original proposal said, by the Federal Reserve, by a combination of the Federal Reserve, a national public bank, or a network of public banks. So that's great for us. You know, that's the first time that it's really gotten introduced in Congress, that concept. Of course, it's gotten all kinds of pushback. And as I said, they seem to be going for the modern monetary approach where the government just has to spend more. But it seems to me they really have to change some laws in order to use the Federal Reserve the way they're thinking of. So it would be great if we could talk to the Green New Deal people. And of course, there's all kinds of dissension that you see in the news. I mean, it's highly unlikely that they'll manage to get their Green New Deal passed, but still they're talking about it. So that's a good thing. If in fact, these were actually ex-Federal Reserve people and economics professors and ex-Treasury people who were proposing that the central bank would open its deposit window to everyone. If if that were to happen, and with this president and his leaning on the Fed all the time, it could happen, it seems to me. If that were to happen, then the big banks, the big objection is that the big banks would lose their deposit base. Everybody would want an account at the central bank because they would get interest and it would be safer. And so the big banks would go bankrupt. And so the objection is, well, then who's going to make the loans? Where are they going to get the liquidity for the loans? But if you had a national public banking system that was hooked up to this central bank, that could be the source of liquidity. And you could make an offer to these banks, say, you can join us. You can become a public bank, and we'll be happy to have you. But, you know, there are these certain restrictions. You're going to be serving the community and not your shareholders. And we could buy out the shareholders. Since the central bank can print money, that could be a form of quantitative easing to pay off the shareholders rather than, you don't want to necessarily confiscate their property. On the other hand, if the banks were collapsing, the value of the stock would go down, down, down. So it might not be very expensive to buy these banks. And there have been proposals to just nationalize the banks. I mean, the next time the banks go down, hopefully Congress is not going to bail them out again, and there's so much disillusionment with that approach. This time they should nationalize them. And the reason they didn't nationalize them last time was that they would be stuck with all these bad loans, and the taxpayers supposedly would have to pay. But they wouldn't. Just move those loans on to see. That's what the 2008 crisis showed us. It showed us what the central bank is capable of. And one thing it's capable of is just moving bad debt onto its own books and buying the debt from the banks. So we could do that. Just move all those bad debts onto the central bank's books and don't even, well, I guess the central bank, the Fed actually got their money back over time and turned a profit on those purchases. But it's because I think they bought them at fire sale prices. So anyway, all this could happen, the first step is for people to understand it so that you get a big public push behind it, it seems to me.
I think that's really, you know, again, like any other black box system, as long as it's working, well, it's working. I don't really care how those sausages are made. It's a tasty sausage. But then when people start getting food poisoning from the sausages, like our economic system, in the short time we have left, what insight do you have about why it is that the gap between rich and poor has grown in this past period of time? And what are the positive signs that you see? You mentioned the millennials. What are the positive signs you see that there can actually become a coherent movement to change how we do our banking?
Okay. Well, the gap has increased, particularly after 2008, because the Fed's bailout has gone to the banks, and that money has gone. We actually have two economies. We have a local economy, productive economy. That's where most of the borrowers are, you know, the individual borrowers. And there is not enough money in that system to pay back the loans. As you pointed out in the beginning, we have a system where debt always grows faster than the money supply because it always involves interest, which that's one reason. It involves interest, which isn't created in the original loans. So if you pay back the original loan with the money that was created in that loan, or, you know, money in the money supply of that amount, where is the interest going to come from? It can only come from more debt. And so you borrow and borrow and the debt goes up. Well, the debts are in the productive local community economy, and that's where the money's not going. It's being siphoned into the wealthy economy. So it's going into the stock market, into offshore tax havens, into real estate that's already built. So you would call that a speculative economy as opposed to building new real estate. Anything where you have money going in to create new supply can go up along with demand and prices won't go up. But if you have a fixed supply, like housing in New York, let's say, and you keep pumping money into it, you're going to drive up the prices. And those people that hold those big properties are going to get richer and richer, while the poor can no longer afford rents, even $4,000 a month for a one bedroom, I saw on average in New York. Horrible. So,
well, you know, that's part of what's going. Yeah, that's part of what's going on is that we have this this two-tiered system where the people who are actually wanting to produce things and make things happen can't get the money that they need to jumpstart their projects. And while all of these other the casino economy, signs do you see that there's an uprising, that there's a waking up, and that things can shift in the next decade?
Well, we have revolutions going on all over the world. You have the Yellow Vests in France and different movements in Europe, and the fact that the Brits are going off the Euro system, and the fact that China and Japan and Asia in general is rising, and that China and Russia are forming their own SWIFT system and their own exchange system that cuts the dollar out. Shows that things are rapidly changing, and things that didn't seem possible can suddenly become possible. Like when Roosevelt took the dollar off the gold standard in 1933, people said he couldn't do it, but he did do it, and it worked. And when Bernanke did quantitative easing, people said, can he do that? But he did do it, and it worked. So we could, with enough enlightenment or enough disillusionment, switch system.
We have both of those. Ellen Brown, thank you so much. I recommend that everybody read in order Web of Debt, the banking, public banking solution, and Ellen's new book, which is Banking on the People. Self-education on this topic is what's going to make the difference. Steve Behrman, I thank you, Ellen Brown, for being our guest on WikiPolitiki today, and we'll catch you next week.